Clegg.
Clegg. Mm-hmm. Let me do it. Hold on a second. Gordon, hold it just a second.
Nobody.
Here in New York, we received, a day or so ago, a new volume, and it's called The Black Messiah. It's published by a firm of Sheed and Ward here in New York City, and it's available at your bookstores now. It's a very interesting book. And on the cover, it says, The Religious Roots of Black Power, a strong and uncompromising presentation by America's most influential and controversial black religious leader. And this gentleman is the Reverend Albert B. Clegg, and he's with me now. Reverend, I'm very happy to have you with us to sit and chat about your book, The Black Messiah.
Thank you.
May I start right off and say, why the title, The Black Messiah?
It's an effort to begin to build a black theology, and it begins with the basic conviction that comes from research and study and historical study that Jesus was essentially a black Messiah, black in the sense of coming from the nation Israel, which was, during the biblical period of the Old Testament, a black nation, having been mixed in the wanderings in Africa of Israel with the black peoples of Africa. Mm-hmm. So it refers back to Jesus as the black Messiah.
I see. And in other words, the establishment of the black church, is that the proper way to put it?
Yes. I refer to it as the black church, meaning the church that black people go to. Now, that crosses denominational lines, but it's still a black church in the sense.
Oh, in other words, this is not an all-encompassing thing. This is the church that the black goes to.
That's right.
I see. Now, Reverend, you are a Protestant minister.
That's right.
And you have a church in Detroit.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we've established now that you are a man of the cloth, and that something like this is native to the black, to assume that Jesus was black?
Well, the first attempt, I think, in America to go back beyond the obvious pictures and things of the Middle Ages and to try to find the historic roots was by Marcus Garvey, which was right after the First World War. And the Marcus Garvey movement was a very powerful movement among black people, and he tried to establish an African Orthodox church, and he had artists paint pictures of a black Madonna and a black Messiah. And at the time, it had a kind of momentary popularity among black people, but it didn't take roots, and beginning now to develop a black theology is practically beginning all over again with the basic idea.
Well, in other words, the groundwork was laid just after World War I.
By Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey. In fact, strangely enough, before I even picked up this volume, I saw one of the pictures that had come out in an album which I had was fortunate enough to be able to go through. It is not the first time we've seen a black Christ or even a black Madonna or black angels, which through the Caribbean you see quite a bit.
Oh, yes.
Now, you have put together actually a series of sermons in this book, The Black Messiah.
Is this
the way it is?
Mm-hmm.
And you've taken as your text, for example, the first one is in Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote, of course, very simply, as most people have read the Bible and know, so God created man in his own image. And in the opening of this, you have said it tends to mix up the minds of people, that statement. I'm perhaps mixed up in the reference there, because to me, God created man in his own image was an all-encompassing thing.
Mm-hmm.
How can you bring this into the picture of the black Messiah and the black church?
Well, I think we have to understand the situation in which black people have lived in America, which has been a situation which is essentially oppressive and which has robbed black people of a sense of dignity, a sense of identity, and a sense of pride in being black and in black history and black culture. And this, in a sense, makes it difficult for a black person who has no love of himself, no sense of pride, to really be in relationship with God, because if God created man in his own image, then man must stand up in dignity before God and have a sense of being a divine creature of God. And I think in a sense that black people have to understand that the experience of being black in a essentially white world, a world dominated by white people, has given it a very difficult problem to black people in trying to measure up to the creation of being actually created by God in his own image. And it's this sense that I try to remind black people of at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Now, Reverend Clage, are you saying that the revolution is here? The word revolution comes in mm-hmm. the book many, many times. May I ask what you mean by revolution? Mm-hmm. Is it in the sense where fireworks and the world blows up, or is it in the case of people learning to exist together?
Well, I think I use revolution in the sense of rapid social change, and I refer specifically to the period since the 1954 Supreme Court decision, the period that's known largely as the development of the movement, which was led by Dr. Martin Luther King,
yes.
and eventually out of which came the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee with Stokely Carmichael and the more militant leadership on the end. But that period, a revolution in which black people have begun to reevaluate their position in America, their relationship with white people, how they're going to function and what their objectives are in terms of being able to change the world in which black people live. Mm-hmm. Before that time, black people had thought of the world as being fixed and not capable of being changed. And during that period, the black church ministered to black people by offering an escape, mm-hmm. A warm fellowship on Sunday, freedom from a hostile world on Sunday, and a sense of emotionalism and promise of otherworldly rewards after death, and I think perhaps as important, the punishment of white people for their oppression in the afterworld. Mm-hmm. But when black people began to think of the world as something that could be changed, then immediately the function of the church had to adjust to this change in the thinking of black people. Black people no longer wanted escape, they wanted leadership in the revolutionary struggle for freedom and justice and equality that black people were engaged in. And this poses quite a problem for the black church. Black militants tend to put the church aside, the black church, and say it's an Uncle Tom institution that doesn't serve the things that we're trying to do now. I think the church can serve what black people are trying to do, can offer leadership, but only if it can go back to the original roots and rediscover the fact that Christianity began as a black religion for black people.
Well, Reverend, are you saying then that the militants are perhaps stepping ahead of the progress, or are they trying to force it too quickly, or is the answer in the black church, or is it in the militantism?
Well, I think black militants certainly, and by black militants I mean black people who have come to the conclusion that we have to have change and have it immediately, mm-hmm. and are willing to do the things that have to be done to make for change. I think the militants certainly have been in the lead as far as pushing the black revolution, organizing the black revolution, making the demands, and actually making the confrontations that are necessary for learning and for progress. And during this period, the church has been very passive, kind of outside the basic struggle. But at the same time, the Christian religion is of basic importance to the vast masses of black people. And if the revolution that the black militants are leading is to have maximum effectiveness, I think then the black church has to be incorporated into the revolution and give the benefit of its institutional experience and its leadership to the revolution, and try to channel the revolution in the most productive lines that it can possibly take.
Well, when you say the productive lines, do you mean that the black should take what is what he considers his, or are you saying that it should be a compromise between the physical action and the perhaps passive action of the church is not the right word, but the encouragement of the church to this?
Well, I certainly am not encouraging passivity, and I'm not trying to suggest that the church enter into the black revolution as a Kool-Aid kind of a influence on the revolution. I think the church comes out of a revolutionary background, which essentially has been lost. I think the black church has to go back and reemphasize the basic teachings of the Old Testament, the teachings of Israel. I think it's important for black people to recapture the sense of nation, where the relationship that the individual has with God is essentially the relationship that he has through his participation in a nation, in a group. And God deals with people as a nation, and this is the whole message of the Old Testament. And this is not an otherworldly kind of approach. It's God's concern with his chosen people here, his nation, and the nation Israel in the Old Testament. Now, in the New Testament, after we get through the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we get into a period when it's not the religion of Jesus, which was the religion that was built on Israel and the teachings of the prophets and the law, but it's the religion about Jesus, which the Apostle Paul put together and is the basic theme of the epistles of Paul and the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, and was the message of the early church, which the Apostle Paul put together.
An interpretation
of a religion about Jesus, which has to do with Calvary and the sacrifice on Calvary and the blood atonement. Now, I think there's a basic distinction there. I think black people during the time when we had no opportunity to change the world and we were seeking for escape found that escape in Pauline kind of Christianity. I think now when we are engaged in a revolutionary struggle, it's well we go back and recapture the religion of Jesus, which is essentially the religion of the Old Testament, added to the Old Testament the revolutionary leadership of Jesus, who was fighting to put a people back together in conflict with the Gentile Roman Empire.
Now, Reverend, we're talking essentially about a Christian religion, but lately we've seen many, can I call them offshoots of the Muslims, perhaps Islam, and a few other groups who are perhaps not as familiar to Americans and Canadians as they would be, let's say, in Asia or in Europe. How do the two, let's say Muslim and Islam, and the Christian portion of it, and Jew too, there's a large Negro Jewish population, is there not?
Yes, there are black Jews in many cities.
How do these groups fit in together as far as the church is concerned? Do they mesh, or do they find themselves at counterpoint, or is there a grinding like a rasp between them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think essentially there's not too much conflict or opposition between the groups. The black Jews in America are a very small group. There are black Jews in other countries who go back to the original strain of Abraham throughout the world. Now, the Muslim religion in America is essentially the religion put together by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which had as its outstanding spokesman Malcolm X. Now, the Muslim religion in America has done a tremendous thing in calling black people's attention to the beginnings of religion in Africa, mm-hmm. and building a pride in African beginnings and African culture. But essentially, the Muslim religion is not the Christian religion, and in most communities, there are now Muslim mosques headed by black people with black Muslim ministers. But this Muslim religion is essentially much more outside of the mainstream of the life of black people in America than the Christian church. Most black people in America are Christians. I think essentially the influence of Christianity among black people has lessened during recent years because of its failure to involve itself and relate itself to the black revolution. The Muslim religion in America has tried to relate itself to the revolution, but has a very difficult time because it's calling people out of one religion and into another, which is very difficult, but it's had a tremendous success in certain areas, particularly in the area of saving black people from penitentiaries and from dope addiction and things that where the Christian church has had no power to actually change people. In this sense, I think the Muslims have done a tremendous job.
Well, now, you mentioned Malcolm X, and I think perhaps many people are confused as to why Malcolm X broke away from the group that's headed by Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. I believe his headquarters are in Detroit. Am I correct?
His mosque number one is in Detroit, mm-hmm. but his headquarters is in Chicago.
Right.
Yeah, that's.
But I think there's probably some confusion as to why Malcolm X seemed to split off from there and almost go off on his own. Is there any answer on that? He died before perhaps he could establish what he was really trying to say. Now, again, I don't know. I'm questioning on this.
Well, I think we have to understand that Malcolm X didn't leave Elijah Muhammad, that he was expelled from the Muslim movement in America by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad because he'd grown very powerful, perhaps too powerful for the institution, and he refused to obey some dictate that was given to him, and which had as its intention to silence him. He refused to be silenced, and so he was expelled from the Muslim movement. Now, after his expulsion, he functioned as an individual and made some effort to put together a organization, but not too effectively, I don't think. But at the same time, he's much more important now religiously to black people and to black militants throughout the world than he was during his lifetime. So his assassination, in a sense, had the same effect as the crucifixion of Jesus. It elevated him to a kind of sainthood so that his words now, his speeches, are still played and read by people, and they almost have taken on the character of gospel as far as black militants in their efforts to put together a revolution. So Malcolm was not too effective in putting together an organization, but his assassination immediately elevated him to a kind of sainthood, which makes him tremendously more important today than he was when he was alive.
Reverend Clage, where do we go from here? Is the militancy going to become stronger, or is the church going to take over on what might be called a reasonable path, an attempt to try and find the answer peacefully?
I think whether or not the militant struggle, the black revolution, is filled with conflict and violence or not is going to really depend on what position white America takes to the demands that black people are making. Now, most of the demands, to my mind, and I could be accused of not being objective, sound reasonable. To demand justice, to demand that black people be treated as anybody else, that black children get the same kind of education, there be the same kind of job opportunities, that black people be able to live any place. These demands really are not going to be dropped by black people. I think the intensity of the struggle to realize this kind of justice and equality for black people is going to continue. So in that sense, the black revolution is going to continue. Now, the black church can either participate in it or stand to one side. And I think if it stands to one side, the black church is going to wither away, because I think black people are going to consider the revolution more important than the black church, unless the black church can involve itself and show that it is relevant to the black revolution. So I think we may find that white people are willing to make the adjustments that are necessary, but they're very slow about making those adjustments. And the recent presidential campaign, I think, marked a kind of a change in race relations. Gunnar Myrtle, a number of years ago, spoke of American race relations in terms of the American dilemma. The white man says one thing and does another. He speaks of democracy and Christianity and love, but at the same time, the things he does are different. He said this is a dilemma in the minds of white people in America. I think during the last presidential campaign, though, Wallace's tremendous contribution to race relations in America was to sort of do away with this American dilemma and say out loud the things that white people had been thinking, and to articulate things that had been left unsaid, so that now there's not the dilemma. Most white people now accept as almost a legitimate expression of of the white man's position in America the things that Wallace said. They may not like the way he said them, and there's a certain feeling that his crudity was unnecessary. But certainly the things that he said were echoed in a different sense, a more acceptable sense, by Nixon and by Humphrey. And many people who ordinarily would have frowned upon the whole thing began to find that there is a position there that is really a part of American life. So the conflict now between the efforts of black people to secure equality and justice, I think, is going to be faced by a much more open opposition, which is not necessarily bad. because I think in the confrontation, white people will learn and black people will learn. And I think it's out of this confrontation and this power struggle that a whole new basis for race relations in America will emerge.
I'm reminded of the old Indian saying of when you see the Indian come up to the negotiators, white man speak with forked tongue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is, I think, what you're really getting at is that. But do you really believe that the majority of Americans, who are white Americans, who are thinking people, really feel this way?
Well, I would say that if you take the Kerner Report as largely put together by white people who could come to the basic conclusion that America is a racist society, I would say essentially what the Kerner Report says is true. I would say that doesn't mean that there are not a lot of white people in America who don't realize that they're racist. And when I say don't realize that they're racist, that sounds like a contradiction. I mean, don't realize that their whole existence is a part of a racist system. Because there are, you know, white people who live in a community, say, that in which no black people live, certainly do not feel that they participate in a racist society. But in a sense, all white people participate in a racist society in that they derive benefits from the fact of the exploitation and oppression of black people. If white schools are better than black schools, it's because money that might have gone into black schools has been taken out and put into white schools so that they have a little more money than the black school. And black people pay rent, which is just about the same for a rat-infested tenement that white person pays for a fairly decent new apartment. And food in the ghetto stores is about 25% higher than food in a suburban store. Now, all of these things mean that there's a total system of oppression. Now, a white person may have no consciousness of it, but he reaps the benefits of his participation in this system of oppression. And it's in this way that we refer to this being a racist nation, not on an individual one-by-one basis, but you can find a lot of white people who have good intentions. But in a sense, they're part of the system. And what we're dealing with is a power struggle kind of thing. Now, white people have a very good habit of being for anything that helps black people without shifting the power base of society. And like the Poor People's March in Washington, there was no power thing there involved. It was just asking the government to make some additional concessions to black people. So all the church people and the kindly intentioned people in the country supported it. But if 10 or 15 black people get together and demand something that involves a shift of power to black people, then white people immediately feel threatened by what black people are doing. So it's this kind of complexity, I think, that makes it difficult for white people to understand what black people are talking about when they talk about black power or the shift of power.
Isn't it, to a certain extent, a mutual education process?
Yeah, I think so. If we mean the same thing, I think black people have gone through a tremendous educational process during the period following the Supreme Court decision. All of the things that happened in the South served to break the black man's identification with white America. I think up to that point, black people felt that integration was possible and would come quickly. But during that period, I think black people began to feel that the white man is not going to accept integration, that it's necessary for the black man to reevaluate his whole position. And so it has been, in large part, this period, a time of black people trying to educate themselves and find cultural beginnings and to go back, jump over the slave ship, and find what was our past in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Reverend, you mentioned Africa. And there's something which came to my mind as I was reading through your book, The Black Messiah. Liberia was established as a black nation, and yet there's been very few, unhappy blacks who have said, I'm going to leave this and I'm going to Liberia, which is my own nation, established for us. Now, again, there may have been many changes, but this, I believe, was the original idea behind Liberia. It was a place where the Negro could go to be his own nation, to rule himself and to establish it. Why has there, using perhaps Israel as an example, where many Jews went to Israel to live and to become their own nation, why has the Liberian nation not grown as perhaps Israel has?
Well, it's a little complicated. I think if we start with Israel, Israel in Germany before Hitler was really integrationist oriented. It probably, I think, Jews refer to it as the most happy experience of the integration of Jews into a country in Germany before Hitler. And then Hitler's, the experience of Nazi Germany and the atrocities of the gas chambers and all the rest of it in the concentration camps led Jews everywhere to begin to feel that there ought to be a homeland for Jews. And the Jews ought to have some place that they can go away from even the illusion of integration that collapses so easily. And it was really out of the experience of Nazi Germany that the Zionist movement became a powerful movement, and Jews from various parts of the world went to Israel. Not too many Jews went from America because the situation mm-hmm. here was fairly mm-hmm. decent for Jews. But now, on the other hand, the beginning of Liberia was not a very fortunate kind of beginning. In that situation, most black people in America did not anticipate going back to Africa, because black people had lost a sense of identification with Africa, and they had accepted pretty much the white man's interpretation, and they felt that it was a kind of a ridiculous thing to go back to Africa at that time. Now, some black people did go back, but at the same time, the country was not independent as Israel was independent. It was under the domination of an American rubber company, and yes. It was a sort of a sophisticated colonialism that black people would have been going back to. But during recent years, since 1954, and black people have begun to build a new image, and they've gone back to understand what Africa means in terms of cultural beginnings. Many, many black people are going back to Africa, to different countries in Africa, but going back to Africa seeking to identify with Africa as the beginning of black people. Yes. Not necessarily to Liberia. Some are going to Ghana, to Kenya, to other parts of Africa. But there is now a tremendous movement from America to Africa. And it's largely among people, educated black people in America, who feel that they have something to contribute to the development of African nationalism.
Reverend, it's been fascinating talking with you, and I've enjoyed it, and I must say that unfortunately our time is coming to a close. I would like very much to ask you to come back again and sit down and chat some more. I've learned a great deal today, and I'm sure that our listeners have gained in your point of view, and I would definitely suggest to them that they go to their bookstore and buy a copy of The Black Messiah. I must, if I may, quote in here from the introduction, where it says, "White people who read these pages are permitted to listen to a black man talking to black people." Mm-hmm. I think it's very enlightening, and I think the book is very good, and I'm sure that our listeners will gain a great deal of the feeling of the black church and exactly what you yourself feel. I must compliment you on writing a very, very interesting book, and I was enlightened with it. And I'd like to thank you, Reverend Albert B. Clage, for coming in and talking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Scott Morrison, Mutual News in New York. Now back to the world today.